This is the Toronto Today podcast. I'm your host, Greg Brady.
We've got some law enforcement issues to talk about right now with the current president of the Toronto Police Association. He is John Reed. Good morning, John.
Yeah, good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. And Hank Nzinga, 640 Toronto crime specialist and a former police inspector. When is your roast, Hank?
That might be upcoming, depending on what happens.
John and I are happy to drop by. We've got some one-liners, two-liners, and three-liners. We're gonna zing you with. So we got a lot of issues cut right out of today's headlines. That's for sure. But John, yesterday, a very important day to recognize what officers risk and what families risk as well. Four police officers' names were added to the Ontario Police Memorial yesterday, a pretty important day to recognize not just their contributions in life, but after as well.
Absolutely, Greg. And I think one of the important things here to remember is we had four officers added, Sergeant Eric Mueller from the OPP, and Constable Stephen Tarangio, also from the OPP, and Chief Edward Lavery from Prescott, and then Sergeant Thomas Whitelaw from the Toronto Police Service. Those are two historical additions. But once again, this is also for the families to know that their loved ones who've made the ultimate sacrifices are not forgotten and will never be forgotten. And it's so important, I think, for the communities to understand that when our men and women go out each and every day, they do put their lives on the line. And the terrible reality is sometimes our members don't come home.
Yeah, this the Eric Mueller one especially was very, very difficult. He went responding to a home 911 call just east of Ottawa, 2 a.m, just under a year ago right now, and was shot. And again, it's not what you expect, John, but you have to be ready for anything at all times. And even when you are ready, we've seen horrible examples in the last 5 years where officers have responded and things escalate very quickly because of what happens inside that house.
Absolutely. And also, but for the grace of God, there are actually two other officers with Eric that day. And fortunately, those two officers survived. But these are injuries and situations, both physically and mentally. So that's going to be with those officers and the responding officers and EMS people as well.
Kank, I'm sure both of you, and I want to start with you here, reacting to the news. When we talked last Monday, obviously it was the day of this horrific crash on the 401, a wrong way driver. There's so many layers to it to re-explain, but an alleged robbery at the LCBO in Bowmanville. A suspect leaves that parking lot in Bowmanville, drives through some residential streets, but then ends up going westbound towards Toronto on the eastbound 401 lanes. Now we find out beyond the obvious, there's clearly going to be some questions asked about Durham Police's response in sending vehicles after that particular suspect going the wrong way at very high speeds on the 401. But we find out a lot more, and it comes right back to our system of bail, given this individual is alleged to have robbed four different places. There's some carjacking allegations as well. It's a huge problem, and beyond the tragedy itself, which none of us can quite picture how we'd even get out of bed in the morning after losing parents and a baby child. We're still come back to this issue of should this person have been out given what he was accused of?
Yeah, I mean, it's raised a whole new issue in regards to this incident, right? First, we've got the issue of the pursuit and should it have happened or not. So we can put that aside for a second here and talk about the bail situation with the suspect. If he's out on multiple releases for indictable offenses and he's not a permanent resident or a citizen of this country, why is he out on bail? It's a great question. I think they have to go back and look at the decision to release him and the conditions under which he was released. Was there a surety? What was the surety doing to make sure he was abiding by his bail conditions? And then go back and say, should he have been released in the first place by the justice of the peace? We've talked about it before. The justices of the peace are bound by some legislation and some case law. And the onus is kind of done a 180 over the decades when it comes to release, where it used to be the accused who had to say, I'm out on an indictable offense charge. Now I've been charged with another one. So I've got to explain why I should be released. And now it seems it's almost automatic. So definitely something that needs to be looked at. And it's federal legislation that can change that.
John, beyond the scope of this massive tragedy, I just think so many people listening, and probably the three of us, just don't feel that the system is working right now. What do your officers say when they see details like this, that this guy is out on $2,000 bail in January? He was given that bail from a justice of the peace in a Hamilton court. He would have been back in court on all these charges just 8 days from now. There just seems like story after story, just not with this massive amount of magnitude of tragedy to it.
So I can tell you, as police officers, they're all incredibly frustrated. But I think even more so, you know, as fathers, mothers, parents, you know, everyone's devastated by such an incident, because that could be anybody driving down the road, unfortunately. But I think there's a larger piece here, and we've talked about this before, and that's the accountability. We have accountability of the courts. We have the accountability of the individual who's being released on bail. We also have accountability of the sureties. And I think when you start breaking that down, so we have individuals that, you know, when they're released on bail, they're promising to abide by particular conditions. And I think, you know, obviously everyone's entitled to bail under the Constitution, which is fair enough. But assume when somebody demonstrates they will not abide by those conditions imposed by the court, back in jail. They should be going back to jail until they're able to prove to the court they can't abide by the conditions. And the same goes for the surety. I've only read this in the paper, but my understanding is even the surety, we've been able, the police service in Peel, they were unable to locate the sureties for this particular individual, which once again is concerning, because sureties are supposed to be responsible for the individual they bail out. And obviously these people had no idea what this guy was doing.
No, John, even if we say the prison system is full up, there are crimes that we certainly, we've got that fine line. We've talked about this with youth carjacking suspects before. Of course, we can't put 14, 15 year olds, in prison for months on end, maybe a couple years on end, but given the delays in trials right now. But they also can't go back to their houses without consequence and go to school the next day and be at the gym or be out on the town. So whether it's some form of house arrest or something, it just feels like we have no middle ground in our justice right now.
So I actually agree with you. And I think one of the key things we should be able to start looking at is starting to leverage, once again, technology. And I realize it can be expensive. Obviously, we don't want, 14, 15-year-olds in prison, but leveraging things like ankle monitoring so that we actually know and can track where these individuals are. Because we all know when some of these individuals are home, they're supposed to be at home with their parents, they're not. They're out, continually commit additional criminal acts. And these are serious offenses, especially with these carjackings.
So I'm going to let you speak to our PO for a minute while I go talk to folks, and we can see what we're going to do, okay?
So in the meantime, ask the constable up here to say that I should be able to get in.
I'm going to have a conversation.
Okay. We're just going to chat with some of the folks.
So in the meantime, you can speak to Sharon, and
excuse
I will take
me. Bring them, because I would like to get in.
We don't want to call the police. They're working on that right now.
Do you think they're not letting you in because they think...
Because I'm Jewish.
Because you have an Israeli accent?
Correct, because I'm Jewish, they know where I'm coming from.
Okay, that was yesterday. I mean, it's 2024, and I watched the video clear as day. I don't think I've got this wrong. A Jewish professor at U of T stopped from entering U of T, like their main property, based on his religious ethnic identity and his accent. So that's a terrible thing. That's a terrible precedent. That's racism. So that's that. This has gotten really complex with the fencing, and that's where I want to get to as well. John Reed's joining us, Toronto Police Association President Hank Ezinga, former homicide detective, 640 Toronto crime specialist. Hank, I'll start there with you. The university erects a fence to make sure that protesters don't take it over, that land over, as an encampment. They do it anyway, and now the fence is utilized by the protesters to keep people out who work for the university. Like, I could say make it make sense, but not much in the last 7 months in our city does. I'd even ask, shouldn't a police officer be going into that fence in 4+ days and just making sure everything's okay?
You know, the University of Toronto has its own police service, and they do report to the Toronto Police Services Board. And they drew a line in the sand 5 days ago, that 10 p.m. deadline, and then they backtracked on it. And it's led to, and it's caused bigger problems. And hearing that clip and watching that clip today, especially being Holocaust Remembrance Day, absolutely breaks my heart. that a Jewish professor can't get into his own place of work. Quite frankly, any Jewish student should be able to freely walk across those grounds towards their classroom, you know, whether they're wearing a yarmulke or carrying an Israeli flag or wearing an Israeli lapel pin. And I'd support the reverse of that, too. This type of behavior shouldn't be acceptable at all. And the University of Toronto really should stand up and say, you know what, peaceful protest, okay, but intimidating and assaulting people because they're Jewish is simply not going to be tolerated, and we're going to get the Toronto police to clear this encampment out.
John, do the Toronto police have jurisdiction in this area, or does the campus have to, do they have to follow the direction of the university in this case? What's your interpretation of it?
So my understanding is that's actually university property. So given that, then it's actually going to be private property. So we'd have to be requested, you know, by U of T to come and assist. But I think the reality here is when they put up that fence, you know, they actually did follow the Trespass to Property Act. And that area was enclosed in a manner that indicated that U of T did not want people on that property. So obviously the people that went into that area now then breached that. So I think the authority is there for the university police to come and remove those individuals if they so wish. But once again, we end up in a position there where it creates more confrontation. And I think that's what everyone's trying to avoid. But ultimately, that fence is up. You know, it's kind of being turned against the university now. So I don't know whether there's an opportunity for them, quite honestly, just take the fence down. Because obviously the students aren't paying for it.
Yeah. So I look and I say, are you saying this has to come the direction they have to follow, the police, I mean, have to follow the direction of the university here? And either in essence, with the fact, I think we'd argue, the last 5 days have been stand down. This is all university jurisdiction, as you note. That's what has to change for Toronto police to be involved in anything to do with the fence or anything to do with what's happening behind the fence.
Yeah, that would be in relation to the Trespass Property Act. If we ended up in an area where there was some kind of issue with the criminality and or public safety issue, then at that point, the police services have the ability to actually attend there and deal with it.
You don't have to wait for the school. If somebody calls 911 from the encampment itself and says something just happened here, or I was assaulted, or I'm about to be assaulted, you don't have to wait at all for the university to step in here.
Absolutely correct, yeah. Yeah. So at that point, our members would respond appropriately, go and deal with the situation at hand and kind of render the area safe, then deal with any kind of criminal investigations that may fall out of that.
I can imagine, and this will be the most obvious statement probably, John, no matter how long we talk, I can probably give you, I can imagine how frustrated your officers are by this, because the general public is really frustrated by this.
Well, I think our members are frustrated, you know, as probably everyone is in society. You know, the general rule of law these days, I'm finding people keep turning their nose to it. And I keep coming back to it. Consequence, the lack of consequence. I honestly believe the lack of consequence, you know, as a kind of a specific deterrent or a general deterrent, is something which, you know, seems to be lost over the last few years.
So, Hank, it sounds like, okay, police won't go in that area without the direction of the university or something more senior than that. Graduation ceremonies are going to happen there in the next couple weeks. And, you know, you've got a personal stake in this matter, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, my daughter just finished her 4-year degree at University of Toronto, and we just moved her home last week. And if this encampment encumbers the graduation ceremonies and the commencement ceremonies, that's a double whammy for her, because her high school cohort lost their graduation due to COVID. And, you know, they battled through it and went to university and successfully completed university. And there's a real risk that they're not going to have any graduation ceremony. Saying, you see the mayors, especially the mayor in New York City, standing up and saying, no, despite these protests, we're going to make sure these graduation ceremonies happen because it's so important. And we need to see a little bit of that from our leadership here in Toronto as well.
How is she, if I can ask, how is she faring with the idea that such a great moment in any ever? I remember my graduation ceremony in 1994 like it was yesterday. I can remember all the details. I'm sure she's eager for it to go on and a little bit restless, worried that it won't.
She's nervous that it's not going to happen. And I think, like you point out, it's one of life's great moments. And the appreciation from the moment will probably become even clearer to her after it happens. If it never happened, she might not be as devastated she would have been if she had been through something like that before and appreciated it. But it's definitely one of life's moments that shouldn't be missed.
John, when you hear that laid out, and when we make the case again, not to go around in circles, but that clearly there needs to be direction from the university, would you advise the public start to put more pressure on the university? Like, we're laying this out because you hear all the complaints. You hear people say, where are the police? Where's the mayor? Where are the other levels of government? If this is strictly private property and this is strictly a university issue, maybe more people need to know that to kind of tighten up the heat or put more heat on them to bring this down if that's what they so desire.
So I would always advocate public support is important, especially in these situations. I can tell you that the Toronto Police Service has received no requests at all from the university for assistance at this point, which is important for everyone to understand. Because, you know, often our members, we're caught in the middle all the time. You know, whether we go in and remove people from an encampment or we don't, we're criticized regardless. And unfortunately, that's where we find ourselves. But in this particular situation, we have no requests from the school for assistance at all.
Yeah. I wonder whether that will change, but like you said, you think that the university needs to see some form of escalation, if you will, either in terms of a 911 call or in some terms of a response. Right now, it's very much a wait and see approach here.
That's what it seems to be at this point, you know. And obviously, I hope that things always remain peaceful in these situations because, you know, anytime there's anything violent going on, it's a risk to our members, but also to the people involved in the incident. And nobody wants that. You know, ultimately, I think, you know, everyone needs to kind of abide by the rules here. And people are not supposed to be there. And that's something the school really needs to address.
Hey, John Hank, I'll leave it there. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for listening to the Toronto Today podcast. We drop the highlights of The Daily Show every weekday morning at 11 a.m. Don't forget, you can hear the entire show on the radio, at home, on your smart speaker. Ask Alexa or say, hey, Google. Play 640 Toronto or Toronto Today. You can hear us on between 5:30 and 9 weekdays on 640 Toronto. Have a great day.